together. We are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. We got to come together, 'cause we are birds of a feather. Or there will never be, Lord of mercy, no love at all. There will never be, yeah, yeah, no love at all. We also got to realize we are one people, yeah. Got to realize that we are one people, yeah. We got to realize we are one people, or there will never be no love at all.
Well, Mr. Freund is taking a little vacation this week. However, not before he put together this special Hour of the Wolf broadcast to be presented at this time. So stay tuned. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org on the World Wide Web. Okay, well, technology marches on. We're going to see if we can't rectify this situation before our guest starts cursing.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Saturday morning program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, Nalo Hopkinson recorded this past July at ReaderCon. Stay tuned.
It's no matter, darling, where you are. I think of you night and day, day and night. Why is it so that this longing for you follows wherever the silence of my lonely room? I think of you night and day, night and day. Under the hide of me, there's a no such a home burning inside of me, and its torment won't be through till you let me spend my life making love to you night and day, day and
And you're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. And do I have to tell you that that was Billie Holiday? I hope not. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And if I sound, a little tinny or something, well, I am actually recording this episode at my house. Second time I've ever tried it, and this time with, well, lower end but easier to use equipment and stuff like that. I am away right now. I'm actually on vacation. And while normally I will turn one of these shows over to Simon locally, as likewise he does when he goes away, and we each get to do a 3.5 hour slot, I have all these different interviews and wonderful programs burning various holes in my audio pocket, as it were. And this is one that has been particularly burning for a little while. Nalo Hopkinson has been on this program a few times in the past, but can't come on live for various reasons, not the least of which is the fact that she lives in Toronto, Ontario. But luck is with me, because ReaderCon was held this year, and I go every year, and Nalo Hopkinson was the guest of honor there. And I was lucky enough and honored myself to be the person chosen to do the GOH guest of honor interview. And that was not only a thrill, but a joy, and really interesting. I hadn't spoken to Nalo in about 2 years at that point. And it was not only a great thing to be able to go over her career from when I first met her, which in fact was at a ReaderCon to that point, but also to catch up on what she had been doing and what she will be doing in the future. However, I did miss her reading. She did a reading, and I was not there. Scott Edelman, himself a fine writer who I have been planning on having on this show many a time, and we have, well, had problems once, preempted by a thon, once by this, once by that, never mind. Suffice it to say, Scott recorded Nalo's reading using his flip audio camera, his flip video camera, what I'm saying, audio camera, his video camera, and, well, we had all kinds of issues there. He had sent me audio, it didn't quite finalize, it wasn't quite done right, I gave him some instructions that I probably would rethink today, and so on and so forth. At any rate, he posted Nalo's reading up on YouTube and invited me to grab the audio from there, which I did. Now, that audio wasn't of the top quality. I really love the flip. I have one myself, but it's not great for capturing audio from a distance. I actually use flips at the New York Review of Science Fiction readings, but I am also, of course, recording for radio, so I'm using two devices. One of these days, I'll figure out how to synchronize the two. At any rate, Scott did record Nalo. He made the audio of that available for us, and therefore we are going to hear her read now.
This is a novel in progress. I am probably about a third of the way through it. It may be the next novel, or it may be the one after that. I wasn't looking where I was going. I know, how many times had Genevieve told me not to look back at a pursuer? Not that she knew bugger all about running. But she was right. You only lost more time looking over your shoulder. Psyched yourself out, did stupid things, such as tripping over your own feet, which I had just done. I stumbled, fell on my butt onto the short, low incline down to the rocky beach. I got my heels under me, but my slide continued. I decided to go with it. The incline was only a few strides long, and speed seemed to be the better part of valor right now. I reached the bottom, stood, dusted my palms off. One of them stung. I put my hand down to steady my fall, and it skinned it for my trouble. I looked back up the incline to the bike path. My pursuer was tracking through the undergrowth on the far side of the path. It glanced my way. I hunched down and did a stooped run over to a huge hulk of junk nearby. The rusted out half of a trunk's front cab partially buried on the shore. I hid behind it and peered through its painless front window. Today, The thing looking for me had the form of a child, just old enough to walk. It was tracking up and down the area on chubby legs. Soft brown curls framed its cherub's face. It wore rugged little baby jeans, turned up at the cuffs in the cutest way. A pair of sweet kitty runners on its feet, white, trimmed with aqua and pink. They were the kind with a red light in their heels that flashed every time the creature took a step. It always got one thing wrong, though, almost like it couldn't help revealing itself. Itself or themselves. I'd never known whether it was the same creature hunting me or whether a different one came every time. Whatever, it always looked different. Today, the detail that gave it away was its hands. They were the size of a grown man's. Not a small man, either. With those hands, the thing heedlessly uprooted the underbrush as it searched for me. The bush out this way got easily 2 feet tall, enough for a person to hide in. My hand pulled up whole thistles, thorns and all, without any sign of discomfort. On the bike path, a motorbike slowly puttered by, idling so low I couldn't hear the engine. Its rider was a comfortably fat guy, big fro restrained by a bright orange bandana, cheerful face. He looked like he'd be good to hug, share a doobie with and listen to while he reminisced about Hendrix. He looked about the right age. He'd taken his t-shirt off and tucked its hem into the back waistband of his shorts. Smart, it was a hot day. I'd been longing to do the same thing. I'd been wondering whether the occasional hiker or dump truck driver would be taken aback at the sight of a woman topless. But for a heavy-duty sports bra. The Leslie Street spit felt like the type of place where the social rules could be relaxed a bit. Then I'd heard the blackbird cussing, and seeing the eldritch child it had been trying to discourage from getting too close to its nest. Damn me for being so absent-minded. I'd been distracted by a first taste of warm weather. The guy on the bike spotted the thing chasing me and nodded a greeting at it. Absently, it gaped its jaws impossibly wide and stuffed a whole thistle plant into its mouth. "Hey," it replied through a mouthful of chewing. It had a deep man's voice that matched the hands. It fastidiously brushed its hands off on the backs of its jeans. It was even creepier, doing something so normal. The guy on the motorbike grinned at it, rode on. Whatever he'd seen, it had given him no cause for alarm or even curiosity. That was the other thing about my hands. They weren't invisible, but no one else saw them quite the same way I did. Glamours didn't work on me in predictable ways. An ozone effervescence to the air tickled at my nose. Storm coming. I was right at the shore of the expanse of the eerie inland ocean that is Lake Ontario. No way to miss the wide, flat thunderclouds spread out over half the sky. Gray-bottomed, it was waddling towards me like a grimy toddler with a full diaper. A fat, wet drop landed on the back of my neck. The storm cloud was about to drop its load, and soon, the thing chasing me must have gotten splattered, too. It flinched as though it had been stung. It yelped and cast the panic looked upwards, and mentally cheered for the storm to come on faster. As I'd learned over the years, my haint didn't much like water. In the back of my mind, when I'd run for the lake, I'd been thinking that in a pinch I could wade right in and try to wait the bastard out. It had been a cold refuge, though, still too early in the spring for the water to have warmed up. Now, with any luck, rainwater would save me the trouble. Nasty brute was persistent, but we'd figured out a few reliable ways to discourage it over the years, my family and I. Probably the only reason I'd survived to adulthood. A few more drops came down, the haint yelped. It scanned the shore, even took a few steps closer in my direction, but the rain thickened suddenly. The haint made a snarling face, then ran off, swatting at the air the whole time. I watched until it disappeared into the dump truck depot off to one side. There was a steady drizzle spattering me now, but I breathed a sigh of relief and silently cursed myself for having let my attention slip long enough that I hadn't noticed that the haint was upon me until it had almost nowhere left to run. I had a look around the truck cab that had been my hiding place. Its lower edge was anchored with crumbling cement blocks, so it had probably been put here as part of the ballast holding together the landfill on which the lower part of Toronto was built. This whole strip of shore was a wild mix of junk and nature, one of those fascinating borderland places that cities foster so well. Thistle and chamomile bushes poked their way through rounded shards of broken china. I stepped out of the shelter of the cab. I needed help, and I knew it. Dad couldn't do a thing for me in his present condition. The storm started herding wavelets ahead of itself to shore. They batted, cat-like, at my sandaled feet. The fine drizzle was misting up my glasses. In a minute, I begged. Can I have 1 minute, two, just 2 minutes? The water seemed to recede a fraction, both in the lake and above it. I could have been imagining it, but I still said a polite thank you. You never know. I began searching the beach. Good thing about waterfront dump sites, they made for lots of drift glass. I found a few pieces, but only one nicely frosted one, and it was colorless, no use to me. In total, my finds were a handful of frosted beach glass pebbles, two black goose feathers and one white one, and a bleached fish vertebrae I found high up on the shore. It was a good inch across. Dad had told us that Mom used to like collecting bones. I looked around. No hand. I squatted down on the sand and began to sort the stuff I'd found. The fish bone was cause for hope. Maybe this time the pieces were a message, not just random crap. One time, a shell from this lake shore had whispered, "Eat your peas," when I held it to my ear. That had been the last time, though. I'd been about 9. Never did start eating my peas. I mean, it's not like she could make me. There was a pockmark in one of the pieces of beach glass. The tip of one of the feathers fit exactly into it. Looked as though the tines of the fishbone would neatly cradle one of the other pieces if I just found the right angle. Hope thumping at my chest, I began trying to mesh the two together. A sudden hiss of rain peppered me, the sand, the water. The wavelets were kissing at the shore again. My 2 minutes were up. All right, I said, I'm going. Bloody hell, I'd have to try to read the message later. There was a bright blue knapsack lying on the ground near where I'd made my descent. It was on its side, gaping open. It had a crumb of sand crusting one edge. It's probably what had tripped me. I went over to it, picked it up. Nothing inside. One strap torn, front pocket half coming off. Not too bad shape otherwise. I dumped my finds into it. From the pockets of my jeans, I tossed in my cell phone and wallet, too. They'd be drier there. I hauled the knapsack onto my shoulders and strode up the short incline to the bike path. The thundercloud was boiling almost upon me now, and though it didn't seem to be quite above me, the baby fists of rain that began pelting down were peppering me and the surrounding area for many yards around. Probably something fancy to do with the curvature of the earth and the speed and direction of the wind. Dad would have known how that worked. Did know, somewhere inside that softening mind of his. I hurried along the path as the wind picked up. The ratio of raindrops to air approached 50-50. Rainwater pockmarked the surface of the lake. The Cicerus was an almost comforting white noise. Thunder rumbled and chuckled. A bright stitch of lightning tore the sky in half a few miles away. It was a longish hike back to the street. I made a mental note to stay away from tall things, trees, telephone poles. So many times Daddy'd warned me as a girl not to hide under trees during the rain. The lake had turned an oddly pretty greenish blue, sort of tidy bowl mixed with almond milk. Usually it was tea-colored. Water in my glasses was making detail difficult to see, but it was good enough for navigating the bike path. Water trickled from my hair into my ears and down the back of my neck. I couldn't help sucking some of it in from my mouth corners. It tasted so sweet, though I knew the skies were as polluted as the soil. If it wasn't Jenby ranting about it, it was Dad, even in his mostly mindless condition. No cobalt beach glass today. Not any red. I could hear her the strongest through red, but in the 5 years since I'd been seriously looking, I'd found barely enough red pieces to fill a thimble. Good for a hint of a whispered half phrase on good days and not much else. A man's voice yelled and I jumped. A couple of cyclists, guys in baggy shorts and loose football t-shirts, came around a bend in the path going the other way. They were hallooing for the glee of wind and rain and weather warming up for enjoying both. I relaxed. Whatever form it showed up in, my hate always came alone and never in the rain. One of the guys splashed his bike through a puddle, holding his legs and feet straight out ahead of him. Got himself splattered in mud, which the rain began immediately tattooing patterns on in his pale skin. He grinned shyly at me. I grinned back and they zipped past me, probably heading towards the beach I'd just left. I wandered a few yards more. I was soaked through and a little chilled. I stopped. There's a snake lying near the edge of the path, half in and half out of the underbrush. It was smallish as snakes went, about 9 inches long, dark green on top, pale yellow along its sides, curled in a figure eight. My first alarmed thought was that the cyclists had run over it in spite or ignorance, as we monkeys will. But it seemed whole. It glanced sideways at me, its tongue flickering to taste my air. Why was it there? If it had been sunning itself on the path, it should have gone back to its lair when the rain started, but there it lay. I looked at it. It looked at me. For a few seconds, we stayed still, cocooned together in the soft sound of the rain. I took a small step towards it. It jerked, twisted its body into a shape that looked uncomfortably rectangular. Then it shook itself loose again, slithered into the new spring thistles and violets lining the path, and was gone. Something was wrong. Dad was in trouble, if I'd understood the snake correctly. Right angles were anathema to Dad. He could only tolerate them in built things, not things that just grew. From inside the knapsack, my cell phone started to ring. If I took it out in this downpour, that'd be the death of it. I hurried a little further, looked around for somewhere that'd be shelter. Only saplings, the open beach, water pouring from the skies. The phone rang and rang and rang. 12 rings, 15. It was only set for 9. I said, I'm trying. The hell of it. I reached into the knapsack for the jangling phone. Maybe I'd be able to hear enough of what the caller was saying before it shorted out. Here, said a voice, a soft voice behind me. Allow me. It was the guy on the motorbike. He sat the bike like most people would sit on a big, comfy couch. He was holding up a vast golf umbrella decorated with a swirl of rainbow colors. He smiled and twirled it. The colors appeared to spiral into its white center. Thank you, I said. I stepped into the shade of the umbrella, fumbled the phone out of the knapsack with wet fingers. Hello? Took you long enough, said Genevieve's voice. You gotta get to the home right away. Lars will take you. Lars? At your service, said the man holding the umbrella. His voice was quiet, but rumbly. I could feel it in my belly. Genevieve, I said, what's wrong with Dad? He might be fine, but he's gone. People at the home haven't seen him since last night. Officially, Dad had advanced Alzheimer's. The care home kept him carefully under lock and key. You were supposed to check in on him this morning, Bijou. Yeah, I know. I've been too busy being fired. Again. I'm on my way. I dropped the phone back into the knapsack. Lars smiled at me. Can you hold the brolly a sec, he asked. Black man, Swedish name, English accent. Jenny's boyfriends were always interesting. I took the umbrella and held it over his boat. He turned behind him and pulled a couple of helmets and a wad of plastic sheeting out of a bag attached to the back of the bike. One helmet was fluorescent aqua splashed with lemon-colored lightning bolts. The other was scarlet with beige and purple smiley faces. The plastic sheeting was fuchsia with starbursts of an uncomfortable green outlined in chocolate brown. Lars balanced the lot between his wide thighs tucked under his overhanging belly. Plastic sheeting turned out to be rain ponchos. He pulled one on, slammed the red helmet onto his head, took the umbrella from me. Your turn. He handed me the remaining gear, waited till I put it on, then snapped the umbrella shut. The rain popcorned down onto my helmet. Lars slid the brolly into a sheath built into the chassis of the bike. Handy, I said. He grinned. Hop on. Not many words to him, Lars. I slipped the good strap of the knapsack over my shoulder, hopped on, wrapped my arms around his solid middle. He was good to hold, even through the crinkly plastic. You ever saw Hendrix perform? I asked him. He raised up off the bike, gunned it a bit. It vroomed into life and we took off. As we went by the dump truck depot, I saw a tiny form huddled under the body of a garbage-encrusted truck. My haint. The wet side of its face glistened and ran a little more than you'd expect from just rainwater. Looked baneful. The hate glared at me. I leaned into Lars's bulk and stuck my tongue out at it. Suddenly it smiled, its mouth too broad for its face. Something spilled, wriggling from its baby lips. Hard to see through the sheeting rain, but it looked like the snake messenger I'd just seen. The hate bit down and a writhing length of its snap fell to the ground. It landed, kept twisting as though it weren't quite dead yet. My stomach twisted with it. Lars gunned the motor and the bike sped up. As we hit the main road, he leaned back a little so that his mouth was next to my ear. I used to be his guitar, he said, in a soft voice that buzzed and tickled at my ear. Jimmy's, I mean. The wind carried the words away and we sped on towards the cheerful rest convalescent home. Where the f*** was Dad? I'm going to skip on to another place. I'm at about 20 minutes, aren't I? So I'll just read another little section and begin. We had to be cut free of our mother's womb. She'd never been able to push the two-headed sport that was me and Janvi out the usual way. Simbies were slippery in the ways of the flesh, but Mom was still human at the time, hadn't yet been exiled to the waters. So for just a few days, she was kind of sidelined while she recovered from the surgery. That gave Dad's family the opening they needed to move in and take over. Because from their perspective, things were a mess. Jenby and I refused, you see. Conjoined twins. Jenby's head, torso, and left arm protruded from my chest. We shared a heart and liver and had only one kidney and 3.5 legs between us. We had 2 stomachs and enough colon for us each to have a viable section come to that. But the lungs were mine. Jenby only got oxygen because she and I shared a bloodstream. She and I could have lived as we were, conjoined, but between us we had what we needed. But here's the real kicker. Jenby had the magic, and I didn't. Far as the family was concerned, Jenby was one of them, though cursed as I was with the tragic flaw of mortality. Jenby and me, my mom had brought us that gift. You might say that my dad married outside the family. To hear some of them tell it outside the species. Most of the family would barely give Mom the time of day when she was still around. They could have stood it if she were just some dalliance of Dad's, a bit of booty call. Even love would have been okay if they kept it to a dull roar. Wouldn't have been the first time that humans and their celestial cousins had knocked boots, but no, Mom and Dad had to go and breed. With Mom unable to interfere for the time being, the family decided that obviously the human doctors of the hospital where we were born had to surgically separate Jenby and me. They put pressure on my dad till he agreed to it. They're not venal, that lot. Just too big for their britches. They've been emissaries of the big guy for so long that they forget they aren't gods themselves, just glorified overseers. The second we were separated, Jenby began to die. There's a guardian that attends births and deaths. He keeps his eye on the young and on the old. The former having so recently left the other world for this one, and the latter soon to depart that way again. That guardian, you might say that he's a border guard. It's his job to send the living on their way and the dead on theirs. If it's not your time, you're not going anywhere. He was there, ready to do his job when Jenby and I were born, the semi-celestial child and our human dog, he was sister. Now it was time for him to escort her back across the barrier between the quick and the dead. He lingered over our cribs in intensive care for an instant. He smiled at us both, chucked us under our tiny chins. He thought we were kind of cute. Then he kissed us each on the forehead and gently picked Jenby up, cradled her in his arms. My dad, grieving, watched him. The guardian gave him a rueful look. Have I mentioned that the guardian is our uncle? Dad's brother. He took Jenby, leaving my dad to weep at my bedside. The guardian should have carried Jenby to the crossroads right away. Instead, he took her to my mom's room. He'd taken a shine to her uncle had. A real shine. The kind that sets brother against brother, starts family feuds. Mom was still dopey from the anesthetic, but uncle took care of that. Plain old unconsciousness was no challenge for the being who shuffled humans from life to death like bees on an abacus. Even in her half-sleep, she'd been begging to see her babies, and now she was fully awake. This was her first time seeing Jenby. But when she clapped eyes on my uncle carrying a gasping asymmetrical bundle whose little mouth pursed like my dad's, she figured out pretty quickly who the baby was and what was up. The guardian's impartial. He has to be. Normally, he wouldn't be put in the position of herding family across the borders between life and death, since the rest of that lot don't die. Not permanently, anyway. Mom begged him for Jenby's life. He replied, there isn't enough of her to survive on this side of the gate. Mom was having none of it. She began making promises. But what does a human have to offer a demigod? She tried to swear her lifelong obedience. Uncle shook his head. In a way, he already has that from every mortal on this plane and the next. But still, he didn't leave with Jenby. Mom's arms ached to hold her baby. She promised sex the best he'd had, and he's got some good stuff. He's not just Lord of the Grave, my uncle. All that born and dying business has given him a taste for the sweetest gifts of the flesh. My mom was fine, they tell me, and she knew what to do with what she got. How do you think she managed to catch the eye of not just one celestial, but two? Thing is, Uncle, for all his lechery, is pretty professional about his job. He shook his head, turned towards the door, but Mom spied the tear twinkling in his eye, and she knew she'd underestimated him. Sure, he liked doing the nasty plenty well, but save her, Mom said, and I'll love you. Uncle stopped, one hand on the door's crash bar, the other supporting Jenby's one-and-a-half-legged little rump. He knows lies, Uncle does. There's a propaganda machine that makes him out to be the prince of them. It's bullshit. Those are the same people that won't let their kids borrow fiction from the libraries. Stories aren't lies, people. Some of them are truer than any autobiography. But Uncle does know how lies taste. Refined sugar sweet, not molasses sweet like truth, that sulfurous backbite. Mom was telling the truth. The room was treacling with it. If he saved her daughter, she would love him. She would love death itself, fiercely and hotly. What parent wouldn't, under the circumstances? Hell, I still love that fireman who saved my cat from my burning apartment even after he turned out to be an asshole. But this story isn't about my sorry ass love life. Uncle looked down at the child he was holding, at her piecemeal body and oddly canted face, her jaundiced skin glowing blue. She had my mom's eyes. We both do. Uncle turned. Mom reached her hand out, took his in it, her eyes brimming with hope. With love enough to fight for her child and more. I can't do it, Uncle whispered. She needs organs, tissues that I can't give her. I'm a ferryman, I can't make her live. I can, said my dad. He walked into Mom's room. Uncle tried to snatch his hand away from Mom's, but she held on and looked Dad full in the face. A mother's love is fierce with pride, and Mom was never one for regrets. Dad read the signs of what had gone on between them, like spore in the room. You want this? He asked Mom. Yes. Brother Mike said, Dad, give me the child. His two eyes made four with Uncle's. In that moment, Dad's eyes were green, the bright green of new spring leaves. Gently, Uncle handed Jenby over. Gently, Dad took her. His first time holding his baby. That was the moment that Uncle violated the border between this side and the next. For once he had taken a soul to himself, he wasn't ever supposed to hand it over until he had delivered it to its destination. If Uncle is a ferryman between the worlds, Dad is a gardener. His talents are growing, grafting, and pruning. Let me go then, now, he said to his dog. Dad said to his brother. What? Said Mum, where are you taking her? Dad said, his voice full of loss. Can't fix her up here. We have to go to the next side. You stay and see to Vidya. He tried on a smile. We're going to bring her sister back to you before you can say Jack Mandora. Uncle embraced Dad. Their circled arms protected Jenby. Mom had to look away from the brothers then. Their aspects were already changing, preparing to cross over to the other side. Mortals cannot look upon that celestial shift for long. It's like looking directly into the sun. Between the glory that was the brothers, dying Jenby was a fleeting scrap of dull flesh. Then the three were gone. Mom clambered back into her bed, closed her eyes, and prayed for both her children. No point imploring the big guy. He has more important things to look after. As so many others do, Mom prayed to the Celestials more directly involved in the affairs of this plane. In this case, her husband and her brother-in-law. Thank you.
That was Nalo Hopkinson reading at ReaderCon this past July 2010, recorded on a flip camera by Scott Edelman. If you want to see some of the other things that Scott recorded, including his own fine and often bizarre fiction, you can go to YouTube, where he has made a number of these things available, including that reading that Nalo just did. And his name is Scott. E-D-E-L-M-A-N. Look for his channel and you'll find more information. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund and we will take a musical break and be back shortly.
Just get your mind together, then come on across to me. We'll hold hands and then we'll watch the sunrise from the bottom of the sea. Experienced. Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Well, I know you probably screaming. Let your little world won't let you go. But who in your measly little world are you trying to prove that you're made out of gold and can't be sold? So, are you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, I have. Let me prove it to you. Yeah, we came yesterday by the wars here to stay. So, my darling, we decided to take our last walk. Such a mess, it's such a mess. Shit, shake things, continue to bring more cars, green pain, idiotic stains, or silver blood, the bloody red, and you and our feet find the sand, and see it straight ahead. Straight ahead. Take hold of my hand. Have you experienced? Have you ever been experienced? Well, I clock says it's time to close now. I guess I'd better go now. I'd really like to stay here. Crawl past.